Crystals of the Heart, written by Crowry's Wormstache, recorded by Super Sarah. To say that Katara is skeptical when Zuko first joins the group would be an understatement. Seeing everyone being on board with it so quickly fills her with anger. Their time in the caves of Ba Sing Se kept playing over and over in her head long before he joined. She sat there, in the cold, damp cave, dimly illuminated only by the green crystals that King Bumi told them about when they first came to Omashu. In retrospect, she had to admit there was something oddly romantic about the shine of the crystals in the cave, but back then, Katara was too terrified to appreciate it. Suddenly, the ceiling opened, and the thought of something hitting the ground echoed through the cave. She spun around to see what it was, and her fear was immediately replaced by anger. There in the dust lay the man who chased them around the entire world. He sat up with a groan. Katara started interrogating him, immediately suspecting a trap. She yelled at him, taking out the years of pent-up rage and pain that she felt because of the Fire Nation's actions. The dishonored prince remained silent, his back turned to her.
"You're a terrible person! You know that? Always following us? Hunting the Avatar? Trying to capture the world's last hope for peace? But what do you care? You're the Fire Lord's son! Spreading war and violence and hatred is in your blood!"
Zuko finally broke his silence, feeling anger rise within him.
"You don't know what you're talking about,"
he snapped at the waterbender. It's not like he chose this life. It's not like his life in the Fire Nation was any good. But this seemed to only fuel her rage.
"I don't? How dare you? You have no idea what this war has put me through! Me, personally! The Fire Nation took my mother away from me!"
At this point, her legs buckled and she had to sit down, on the far side of the cave, not facing the firebender. The girl's words struck a chord with him. He slowly turned to face her.
"Then that's something we have in common."
Despite herself, Katara too turned around. Regardless of what she might think of Zuko, she knows the loss of a mother is a pain that transcends their differences. Something deep within her urges her to give him a chance. Slowly, cautiously, they walk up to each other, still keeping their distance, as if they expect the other one to attack any minute. Katara asked about the huge scar covering the majority of the left half of the prince's face, realizing she has no idea how something like that could possibly happen. After a moment of hesitation, Zuko told her about the war meeting on that fateful day, the offense he was guilty of, and, finally, the Agni Kai itself. The girl's stomach dropped. Surely no father would treat his own son this way. But then again, this was Fire Lord Ozai. A wave of sympathy and compassion washed over her, and she felt something cold on her chest. Then it hit her.
"Zuko, maybe I can help,"
she exclaimed, stepping a little closer.
"It's a scar. Scars can't be healed,"
he objected warily. Katara showed him the vial hanging around her neck and explained the magic properties of the Spirit Oasis water and how it should only be used in grave situations. The prince seemed to accept, and she stepped closer, gently placing a hand over the scar. It felt rough and leathery. Zuko closed his eyes and leaned into her touch, cherishing the sensation of a gentle touch. Katara became acutely aware of the sheer intimacy of the situation. She had a feeling the firebender didn't usually let people this close, let alone touch his face. Katara was a fighter at heart, but she wanted to help people in any and all ways, including healing. She wanted people to trust her and her healing abilities. Despite the fact that this man was the sworn enemy of her and her friends, after hearing his story, she didn't see why he should bear this mark, and she appreciated the trust he put in her in that moment, because she genuinely wanted to help him. For a moment, she reciprocated that trust. For a moment, they weren't enemies. For a moment, they were just two people, who both drew the short straw when it came to the war's influence on their lives. She never got to heal his scar. The rest of that fateful day is a blur. Aang and Zuko's uncle crashing suddenly through the wall, as well as Azula and the Dai Li a few moments later, Iroh taking it upon himself to hold them off, then Zuko choosing Azula's side, Aang entering the Avatar state, a flash of lightning, Aang's lifeless body in her arms, their hasty escape. Katara was angry at herself for a long time after that. Of course she shouldn't have trusted him. Of course he was going to betray them. Of course it's all been a lie. She was mad at Zuko too, but mostly she was annoyed at the fact that she should have known better than to trust the man that hunted them around the entire globe for the better part of a year. She made peace with herself eventually, though. She spoke to Sokka about it, having nobody else to go to for advice. He put on his therapist beard and listened, occasionally giving the beard a stroke or two. Finally, he spoke.
Katara, deep down, you do realize that it's not actually that much of a big deal, though, right?
What are you talking about? Of course it is! I trusted him! Why, pray tell, would I, or anyone who isn't out of their mind for that matter, do that?
Sokka sighed. Because you're a good person, Katara. At that moment, it didn't matter who he was or what he'd done. You found common ground. A common pain, for that matter. And sympathy is in your nature, Katara. You saw a person in pain and you felt for them. That's all there is to it. You've done nothing wrong.
Katara pondered this. She didn't like it much, but Sokka undoubtedly had a point. She knew that. Still, she was ready to let the Fire Nation prince freeze to death back at the North Pole if it wasn't for Aang. What changed? She had no idea, and neither did Sokka. Still, the therapy session made her feel more at ease with what happened between them in the cave before the fight went down. However, it didn't lessen the emotional turmoil in regards to Zuko in the least. Katara doesn't forget betrayal, and she most certainly doesn't forgive it. The last time someone betrayed her trust, she froze him to a tree, and when they met again, she wasn't too eager to trust him in the least either, even though she gave in the end. The situation with Jet was different, though. No actual harm has been done. No people got hurt. Meanwhile, Zuko and his monster of a sister nearly killed her closest friend. If it wasn't for the Spirit Oasis water, it would have been the end. The end of the Avatar cycle. The end of the world as she knew it. The end of everything. Katara was painfully aware of the fact that she was just about to waste it on Zuko, and there would have been no way to save Aang if she did so. Sometimes, she thought about whether or not that was part of the Firebender's plan too, which sent her back into the rabbit hole of rage again, until she managed to reason with herself that he couldn't possibly have known about the vial in the first place. It's far from an excuse for what he's done, but it always helped her calm down. Other times, her thoughts would take off in a completely different direction. She thought about what exactly happened just before the prince turned on them. Turned on her. Zuko stayed back to talk to his uncle, who, as far as Katara was concerned, was the first and only person in the Fire Nation who was at least vaguely trustworthy. She was certain he wouldn't advise Zuko to attack them. He had made it very clear the last time they met that he meant no harm and didn't necessarily support his nephew's choices and actions. If anything, he's always tried to stall. No, it definitely wasn't his talk with Iroh that made him switch sides, Katara concluded. That left either the possibility that he never changed in the first place, and it really was all some sort of an intricate trap, or his sister got under his skin. Katara could never say for certain which one it was, but she couldn't deny the quick change of several different emotions on Zuko's face before he attacked. He didn't come in determined to try to capture Aang again. There was hesitation, frustration, and finally desperation written all over his face, in that order. It was quite clear from his first attack as well. It was not planned out, nor was it controlled. It was several quick fire blasts in the Avatar's general direction, but certainly not thought out. It was this lack of resolution in his actions that made Katara believe that it was Azula's doing, rather than Zuko pulling an act and then revealing his true intentions. Deep down, she hoped that it really was the case. She hoped she wasn't entirely wrong about him, that day in the soft glow of the crystals. She wanted to see the good in him. Aang was really getting to her, she thought. Either way, Katara is still not too eager to accept Zuko into the group, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if it was really due to Azula talking to him or not. He should have known better. She doesn't understand how the others could agree to this so quickly. Clearly, if he's turned on her, them, once, he's perfectly capable of doing so again, and is therefore unreliable and not to be trusted. The first night he stays with them, she comes to his room to give him a piece of her mind and an idea of just what's going to happen to him if he ever as much as thinks of betraying them again or putting Aang in danger. She feels better after that, since it relieved some of the pent-up anger. Days pass, and much to everyone's growing discomfort, Katara's attitude towards the new member of the group doesn't change. Zuko has had enough. Katara's passive aggression put everyone in a constant state of uneasiness, and it wasn't doing anyone any good, not to mention it's getting frustrating to have all his efforts to be on good terms with the waterbender rejected. He tried to talk to her once, and it backfired, so he goes to Sokka instead. Upon entering his tent, he sees that the boy clearly expected someone else. Zuko looks away, but it's too late. The image of Sokka stretched out in what is obviously supposed to be a seductive pose with a rose in his mouth is forever burned into his memory. It's right there, next to the image of his uncle in the hot springs back in the Earth Kingdom. Regardless, Zuko manages to compose himself and inquires about the fate of their mother, explaining that he wants to get through to Katara and convince her to, at the very least, give him a chance. The conversation was more fruitful than he could have imagined. Zuko realizes he won't be able to sleep tonight, so instead, he sits in front of Katara's tent through the night, revising what he'll say to her. He does doze off eventually, and is woken up by Katara's harsh voice that she only ever uses when talking to or about him. It stings a little.
"You look like crap," she says and walks by,
clearly not planning on any conversation. Determined to go through with the plan, Zuko follows her.
"Katara, wait. Just hear me out for once."
"And why, pray tell, should I do that, Your Highness?"
The last words slowly drip from her mouth and are filled with poison. Zuko winces a little, but doesn't give up just yet.
"Because I can help you avenge your mother."
Something changes in the way Katara looks at him. It's still hostile, but for the first time, there's a hint of something else. After a long while, she speaks.
"How?"
That's all Zuko needs. He leads her a little further away from the camp, quite certain not everyone would agree, and explains the plan. Katara ponders it, and they exchange a few more words in hushed voices before joining the others again.
"Aang, I'm borrowing Appa for a few days," the waterbender says in a resolute voice that leaves no room for discussion.
Aang does not pick up on it.
"Oh? What for?"
"We're going to find the man who killed my mother."
Aang tenses. He finally notices Katara's expression and the tone of her voice. He knows what she wants to do, and it makes him sick to think of Katara as a murderer. He tries to reason with her.
"Katara, you don't have to do this."
"Yes, I do. There is no other option," she snaps and starts packing her things.
"You're wrong. There is. You can choose forgiveness."
From the look on Katara's face, Zuko can tell that hearing any more of Aang's pacifist ideas will make Katara explode, figuratively and possibly even literally. She is not in the mood for diplomatic approaches. He steps in.
"Yeah, right, Aang. Like that ever helped anyone?"
Katara raises an eyebrow at him, but doesn't seem to mind. Aang tries again, addressing both of them this time.
"Guys, please! Violence is never the answer! Katara, you need to let it go!"
Katara stops. Slowly, she closes her knapsack and throws it over her shoulder. Her rage-filled eyes pierce Aang.
What I need, she says coolly, in a tone that's disturbingly calm in comparison to her expression, is to know who could possibly be so cruel that they would rob a child of their mother. What I need is to find that monster and bring him to justice. And frankly, Aang, she adds after a beat, voice still deceivingly calm, though both Aang and Zuko are quite aware of the rumbling of the sea behind her, reflecting her anger. What I need is none of your damn business. We're leaving. She storms out of the tent, not sparing the boy a second glance. Zuko brushes past him awkwardly, grabs his own knapsack, which he packed last night, and mounts Appa. He isn't even properly seated yet when he hears Katara give the call and they take off. He resists the urge to look back at Aang. They don't speak much. There's a storm of emotions raging inside Katara. Guilt for being mean to Aang, soon replaced by anger at the, so far, nameless man they were hunting. A kind of twisted excitement and finally, mistrust. After all, it was Zuko. The firebender senses Katara is working through her own thoughts and feelings and decides not to push it, only speaking twice throughout their journey. Once to let her know that he packed an extra set of black clothes for her, assuming she didn't have one of her own, and then to offer to take her place at the reins so she could rest. It's her fight, not his, and she will need all her strength. Katara accepts the clothes begrudgingly. She should have thought of that. Zuko fixes his eyes on the horizon ahead to give her privacy. Katara has to admit that the clothes are quite comfortable and snug, something she didn't expect. Once she's dressed, she goes over to Zuko and takes the reins from him. Zuko obliges, though it takes him a moment to react. He takes in Katara's figure, somehow more prominent in the tight clothes than in her two-piece dress in the colors of the Fire Nation. What's the matter?
It's nothing. I've just never seen you in black, that's all. It suits you.
She shrugs and switches places with him, not giving his words much value. Zuko slumps back on the saddle and yells at himself in his mind, not only for the way he spoke, that was too awkward even for his taste, but also for staring at her in the first place. He still knew proper etiquette. That certainly wasn't a way to treat a woman, much less one like Katara for that matter. Once they land, everything happens fast. They take out one soldier after another, fighting in perfect harmony, as if they had practiced this for ages. Katara is genuinely surprised at how well she and Zuko work together without any need for words, but there is no time to ponder it for long. They barge into the commander's cabin, and Katara immediately subdues him with her bloodbending. A shiver runs down Zuko's spine as he realizes just how close to death he's been every time he was near her back at camp when her rage fits were directed at him. After some interrogation, they get the name of the man they were looking for and leave the ship. There isn't much conversation now, either. Katara holds back tears of frustration. She used her bloodbending on a random soldier. She can practically feel Hama's triumphant grin. Zuko, on the other hand, is still processing the realization of just how deadly Katara could be if she ever chose to. They land in a small, remote village in the Fire Nation not even Zuko has ever heard about. They quickly find their target and follow him through the bushes, ignoring the rain. Finally, they attack, and the murderer falls to the ground. It turns out to be a frail, helpless old man. He shows no emotion, but is anxious about what Katara will do. She could snap this man in half with as much as a flick of the wrist. He knows that now. She has to do what she needs to do, otherwise she won't be able to heal. Regardless of what she'll decide to do to the man, Zuko will support her decision and defend it in front of the others if need be. The two of them speak, but Zuko doesn't really listen. Suddenly, the rain stops. Zuko realizes Katara waterbended a hull around them, vaguely resembling an igloo. He looks at her and the man and can't help but wonder if this is how it was back then. Katara screams, and the hall turns into 1,000 icy daggers that launch at the man cowering on the muddy ground. Zuko holds his breath. The daggers stop midair, inches from the culprit's face. Katara melts them and drops a wave of water on him instead. Zuko feels relieved, though he's not really sure why. They head back to where they left Appa in silence. Suddenly, Katara stops in her tracks. Zuko only notices after he's a few steps ahead of her, but then he turns around. His heart breaks a little. The waterbender stands there, head bowed, arms wrapped around herself, shoulders trembling as she struggles to hold back the sobs. Slowly, he makes his way back to her, careful to leave her enough space.
"What's wrong, Katara?"
The girl opens her mouth to say something and comes undone. She wails and sinks to her knees, tears streaming down her face. Zuko kneels down in front of her and puts a hesitant hand on her shoulder. Katara is either too distraught to notice or doesn't care, both of which are fine with Zuko. He's just glad she doesn't shrug him off.
"My entire life I was waiting for this moment, to avenge my mother, to see the monster who did it. And then it finally happened and I couldn't end his life. Spirits, and I was rude to Sokka when he tried to tell me this wouldn't change anything, and I..."
Unable to continue, she hides her face in her hands. Zuko cannot watch this and not do anything. Slowly, gently, to give her time to resist, he puts both his arms around her and pulls her into a hug. She doesn't pull away, just presses into his chest, her tears soaking into his clothes.
"Katara, it's okay. You knew this wouldn't bring your mother back, and I'm sure Sokka didn't take it personally."
"I'm weak. I couldn't do it."
"You value human life. That's not weakness, that's admirable. You're capable of something my forefathers couldn't even grasp the concept of. For what it's worth, I support your choice, and I think you're amazing."
Katara doesn't respond. They stay like that for a long time, their bodies drenched in the cold rain. Finally, they pull apart. Katara tilts her head back to look up at him. The firebender meets her eyes.
"Zuko?"
"Yeah?"
"Thank you."
"What for?"
"For coming with me. For doing this for me. For not judging me and letting me do this my own way. I'm sorry for how I treated you before."
Zuko doesn't know what to say. It was so unexpected that he just stares at her in confusion. She gives him an uncertain smile.
"Let's get back to the others."
The mood is completely different on the way back to the camp. For the first time since Zuko joined the team, there's no tension between them. Katara still doesn't talk to him much, though he suspects it's because she's working through her feelings about what happened. He sits next to her at the reins, looking at her every so often. Sometimes she looks back at him with kindness in her eyes, and Zuko feels a lump in his throat. There are very few people in his life who ever looked at him like that. Other times, she keeps her eyes fixed at the horizon, and Zuko can't help but notice she looks beautiful in the dim red light of the sunset. He feels his inner flame flicker in a way he isn't used to. Ever since their trip, the atmosphere at the base is friendly and comfortable, much to everyone's relief. Zuko half expects Katara to return to her previous hostility any day, but it doesn't happen. If anything, she's even nicer to him than the rest. He asks Sokka about it, but he merely shrugs.
"I suppose she wants to make up for before."
Zuko doesn't know how to feel about this. He doesn't want her to feel guilty. He just wants them to be friends. But he has to admit, it does feel good to finally be on speaking terms with Katara. She talks to him now, both in the group and in private. Sometimes she'll meet his gaze and smile at him, or laugh at his jokes, and her melodic laughter sends a shiver down his spine. He enjoys making her laugh, seeing her happy. When he looks at her now, the flame within him burns bright, and he senses it's the same feeling he had when he gazed at her under the Elpenglow, wind blowing through her curly hair, back on the day they went to avenge her mother. It's just that the feeling is much stronger now. Katara no longer feels any resentment for the Firebender after their solo mission. She's surprised by this at first, but then she thinks back to the whole thing. She thinks about how Zuko stepped aside to let her deal with the situation, with a killer and with her inner conflict in a way she saw most fit. She thinks about his warmth against her body, cold from the rain and the shock. She thinks about how he let her speak and just held her in the downpour until she was ready to let go. They talk about their mothers sometimes. Compare what they were like. What has changed for them once their mothers were gone? Katara realizes that she never felt this comfortable with opening up about it to anyone. Whether it's because Zuko was in a similar situation or because they grew closer together, she cannot say. All she knows is that the prince understands her in a way the rest of the group does not. They share a bond she cannot name. Katara feels immense relief that Zuko really was the man she met in the caves. She finds herself wanting to spend more time with him, makes an effort to speak to him more often, and enjoys it a lot. Zuko has a way of making her laugh, even when she doesn't feel like it. Soon enough, she enjoys his company the most.
Guys, you'll never guess what we found!
Sokka hollers as he approaches the camp, his arm wrapped around Suki's waist.
What is it, Sokka? Another wanted poster?
Not this time, but good thinking, Katara, chuckles Suki. Sokka continues.
There's a play about us tonight!
There's a what? There's a what?
Zuko and Katara yelp in unison. Toph bursts out laughing.
Look at that! Sugar Queen and Sparky sure are in sync!
Katara and Zuko exchange glances and then look away, the slightest hint of a blush creeping up their necks. Sokka ignores this and continues.
A play! About us! Tonight! Listen to this,
he says as he lets go of Suki and reads the theater poster he brought.
The Boy in the Iceberg is a new production from the acclaimed playwright Pu-on Tim, who scoured the globe gathering information on the Avatar, from the icy South Pole to the heart of Ba Sing Se. His sources include singing nomads, pirates, prisoners of war, and a surprisingly knowledgeable merchant of cabbage.
Toph snickers.
Well, sounds like something we definitely should go see.
Toph, you can't even see!
Touché, Sokka. Touché.
There's a lot of arguing about whether or not it's safe to go out, but eventually it's agreed that it can't hurt as long as they make sure to sit somewhere in the back. Thankfully, they go unrecognized as they head to their seats. Zuko sits down next to Katara, which she welcomes with a smile. He can feel his heart race at the sight. He is happy. And then the play starts. They can't figure out if it's intentional satire or if the Ember Island players just really are that bad, though Zuko points out that it's probably both, given how they butchered Love Amongst the Dragons every single time. The crew seems to have a particular talent for messing up anything they can find. From Zuko's scar being on the wrong side, to Aang being played by a girl, to the slit on Katara's dress, everything about it is just wrong. The only one who has no complaints is Toph, who, to everyone's surprise, was rather excited by having a buff guy play her role. The production is bad. The actors are worse. But what's the absolute worst is the scene in the caves of Ba Sing Se.
I have to admit, Prince Zuko, I find you really attractive,
confesses the Katara on stage.
You don't have to make fun of me, grouches Zuko.
But I mean it,
Katara insists. Eventually, the actors end up huddling closer together and holding hands, presumably to show that Zuko and Katara were, in fact, a thing. The prince and the waterbender in the audience meet each other's eyes and then quickly look away, both blushing. They're saved by the break and each go their separate ways to think. Zuko knew at this point that the play was a mockery, but he couldn't help but wish that the real Katara would reciprocate too. He'll have to talk to her eventually, he knows that, but would like to put it off as long as possible. Katara, on the other hand, is confused. Seeing herself being this close to Zuko on stage was awkward, yes, but it awakened a yearning within her. She was already suspecting she might be getting feelings for the prince, but pushed them aside because war is no time for love. The play, however, forced them back into her mind, and now she couldn't stop thinking about it. She's convinced Zuko doesn't feel the same way. After all, how could he after all the things she said to him before their field trip? The second half is somehow even worse. Zuko dies while yelling about his honor. Fire Lord Ozai defeats Aang far too easily, and then it's over. On the way home, the gang bashes the play, pointing out all the things they got wrong. Except Zuko and Katara, that is. They both remain oddly quiet, each lost in their own thoughts. Naturally, the rest of the group makes remarks about the scene in the caves too, and try to get them to say something about it, but once it becomes evident that neither one is going to talk, they drop the subject. Katara can't sleep for a long time. She keeps trying to figure out her feelings. She thinks about how Zuko opened up to her in the caves. She thinks about how she almost healed his scar. She wishes she still could. She thinks about their field trip again and how comforting the feeling of his warm body was when he held her. She thinks about Zuko and Katara holding each other again. And she hopes that someday they will too. A shot of blinding white light. A scream. Zuko's body spasming on the ground. Zuko just saved her life. Now she has to save his. But first, she needs to take care of Azula. It's not a long battle. Azula is tired, sloppy, and on the verge of madness. Her attempts to break the chains are meek and useless. She screams and breathes fire, but Katara pays her no mind. She sprints towards Zuko. The prince is alive but weak, and she needs to work fast. His breathing is shallow, and his pulse is dropping rapidly. Quickly, she uses the water from her water skin to begin healing. After a few excruciatingly long minutes, Zuko opens his eyes.
Katara, thank...
He's cut off as Katara launches forward and kisses him. It's wet, sloppy, and salty from her tears, but Zuko will be damned if it's not the best kiss he's ever experienced. Certainly the most craved one. After the war is finally over, they all agree they deserve a vacation. Suki and Sokka travel to the Earth Kingdom. The rest heads directly to Omashu. Toph and Aang go to see Bumi. Aang because there's a lot of catching up to do with his, quite literally, oldest friend, and Toph because she wants to spar with him. And Katara takes Zuko to a special place.
So it's another cave, huh? How original.
Zuko chuckles.
Hey!
Oh, come on, Katara. You know I don't mean it.
He says softly, taking her hand into his, interlocking their fingers.
I'm just teasing you,
he adds, giving her hand a gentle squeeze.
I know.
So, tell me, what is it about this cave that makes it so special?
It's called the Cave of Two Lovers. They met on top of a mountain that divided their two villages.
The villages were enemies, so they could not be together, but their love was strong, and they found a way. The two lovers learned earthbending from the badger moles. They became the first earthbenders. They built elaborate tunnels so they could meet secretly. Anyone who tried to follow them would be lost forever in the labyrinth. But one day, the man didn't come. He'd died in the war between the two villages. Devastated, the woman unleashed a terrible display of earthbending power. She could have destroyed them all, but instead, she declared the war over. Both villages helped her build a new city where they would live together in peace. The woman's name was Oma, and the man's name was Shu. The great city was named Omashu as a monument to their love.
That's so beautiful. So tragically beautiful,
whispers Zuko. It really is, Katara nods. At this point, they're already walking through the innumerable tunnels in the cave, Zuko's firebending illuminating the way. Suddenly, Katara stops. There's something I want you to see.
What is it?
Extinguish the flame and come closer.
But...
trust me. Reluctantly, he obliges, and darkness engulfs them. He feels Katara's hands making their way up his arms and resting on his shoulders. He feels her weight shift onto his shoulders as she stands on her tiptoes. And then he feels her soft lips against his own. The cave lights up. Dozens of tiny crystals in the walls and on the ceiling shine around them, illuminating the cave.
What is this, Katara?
Zuko asks as they pull apart. The girl smiles up at him. It's how they found their way through the tunnels, she says. Love is brightest in the dark.